You might wonder how I manage be cool for me to have Dr. Ramachandran here for all of us tonight. As most of you know, he's a world famous neuropsychologist and scientist. And I can tell you what motivated me. I knew Dr. Ramachandran through some of my own studies. But it never occurred to me to actually invite him to my brand new bookstore to be a speaker. And I can tell you that what motivated me was sort of fear. I was with Elaine and negotiating for my lease, and it turns out that the property manager who's here tonight, Rose, saw my CV and she said, "Oh my God, do you know Dr. Ramachandran?" And I said, "Yes, as a matter of fact, I do." And Rose knew of his work and knew what a wonderful speaker he was and how wonderful his research was, and I thought, I thought quickly, and I said to Rose that
she's good at this.
And I'm keeping good on my promises. Dr. Ramachandran has agreed to be the inaugural speaker, I guess that's what you call it, for the Brain Mind series that I'm initiating here at the Bookworks. I'd like to thank the Panikin for allowing us to use their space. It'll be the occasional scene that you'll hear from the cappuccino being made, and we just have to ignore that. They, of course, have their business that they need to run as well. And tonight, also, we're being filmed by the Science Network, and there's Roger Bingham to thank for that, if you can ask him any questions. And there's Mike back there on the camera if you want to get in his face and be on TV, cable TV. Now, Rama is a professor at UCSD. Oh, do you have some music?
No.
Oh, friends. Here we are. Ramachandran did his PhD in Cambridge, and after that he came to Caltech in Pasadena, and he did 2 years of postdoctoral research there, and then he came to UCSD, where he has been in the Department of Psychology. Along the way of doing his wonderful research, he's become well known worldwide, and he's also had too many rewards to mention because of his accomplishments. Some of the most prestigious, oh, I should say that he's director of the Center for Brain and Cognition at UCSD. He's a life fellow of the Royal Institution of London. Some of you might not know anything about the Royal Institution, unless you're British. Or a scientist, and the one thing that everyone can connect with is that the test tube was actually invented at the Royal Institution. So all kinds of people, you know, many people that go back for many hundreds of years in science. And he has been awarded the Henry Dale Medal from the Royal Institute. And in 2003, he gave the BBC Wreath Lectures, the first of which was given by the philosopher Bertrand Russell. So we really are a very sophisticated company tonight, and I can't thank you enough, Rama, for being able to speak to us this evening. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to begin by thanking Lisa Stefanacci for inviting me. I'm delighted and I'm honored. It's wonderful that Lisa has decided to bring some culture here to Southern California. I always felt that this institution, the Panikin and the bookstore, has a venerable history, as you all know. Always thought of it as a little oasis of culture in middle of nowhere, actually. So I'm delighted to sort of continue this tradition of scholarship and contribute to it. So the books I'm going to talk about, are based on my research. And what I study is, what I'm interested in the functions, structure and functions of the human brain. And there's a picture of it there. As you all know, it's almost a cliche these days to say that's the most complexly organized form of matter in the universe. But if you just think about it, here is this 1.5 kilograms of jelly you can hold in your hand. And this mass of jelly in your hand can contemplate the vastness of interstellar space, the meaning of infinity, and ask disquieting questions about its own place in the universe, in the cosmos. Who am I? How come I arise in this mass of jelly? okay, can begin to even reflect on itself. And this is truly astonishing, and people have described it as the next great frontier. So how do you go about studying this? Well, there are many different approaches. One approach, for example, pioneered by Tom Albright here, is to record from cells in the brain to find out what they're doing and trying to figure out the circuitry of the brain by recording from individual cells. The other approach, the one I use, is to look at patients, or indeed normal people, who have a small change in some part of the brain causing characteristic functional disturbances, characteristic changes in their minds. And then you can look at these deficits, these changes, correlate them with the parts of the brain that are involved, and then try and understand how, not only why the patient manifests these curious symptoms, but how the normal brain works. And that's our real agenda, understanding of the normal brain, and hopefully apply some of the science to treating patients, neurological patients. So given our time limits, I'll just mention two or three examples of this. So our strategy is to bring people with syndromes like phantom limb or synesthesia or Capgras delusion or autism, syndromes have been known for a long time but have been largely been ignored by mainstream neuroscience and psychology, and then bring them from the clinic to the laboratory, do some simple experiments, as you will see. Question is, what can you learn about you and me, the functions of your brain and my brain, by studying these patients? Okay, one example which is already widely publicized, so I'll only go over it very briefly, is the syndrome of phantom limb. So a person loses an arm or a leg in a car accident, or these days in a battle, and they come back, and the amazing thing is they still continue to feel the presence of this missing limb. This is called a phantom arm or phantom leg. Now, why does this happen? I became interested in this over two decades ago, and then I was studying a patient who was sitting in my office, blindfolded him, took a Q-tip and touched different parts of his body, asked him, what do you feel and where? So he said, oh, you're touching my chest, you're touching my forehead, you're touching my belly, and how about here? This chap has lost his left arm above the elbows. He had a phantom left arm. I touched his face and he said, oh my God, you're touching my phantom thumb, my missing thumb. And he was as surprised by this as I was. And I said, how about that? Well, that's my phantom index finger. How about that's my phantom pinky? In fact, there's a complete map of the missing hand on the face. So this is a mystery. Why does it happen? So I was looking at this diagram, which is the Penfield map of a normal person. If you record from the surface of the brain, it turns out there's a complete map of the opposite side of the body, of the skin surface, on this ventral strip, which is running down the surface of the brain, that brown strip in the back of that furrow in the middle. That's called the postcentral gyrus. And this is a cross-section. You can see different body parts are represented in the postcentral gyrus. And it's a systematic point-to-point map of the skin on the brain. But one peculiarity is the face is not where it should be, up near the neck. It's dislocated. It's below the hand and near where the hand is. Now, that instantly gave me the clue. And I said, what's going on in this chap and other patients like him? They've lost the arm. So the area corresponding to the missing arm, missing hand, is now deprived of sensory input. So that patch of neural tissue doesn't get any sensory input anymore because the arm has been amputated. So what happens is it's hungry for new sensory input, so to speak. So the sensory input from the face, the adjacent face region, invades the territory corresponding to the missing arm. So there's a sort of cross-wiring or cross-innervation, so that when you touch his face, the message not only goes to the face area like it should, but it also goes to the hand area, right? And the brain then misinterprets it at some higher level as arising from the missing phantom hand. So here's an example of taking a bizarre syndrome and a bizarre observation, clinical observation, and then looking at the brain circuitry and figuring out what's going on. You can then do fancy brain technology, in this case, MEG, which we did with Floyd Bloom and Tony Yang, who's a medical student working in our lab at that time, and show that this is what actually happens in the brain. This reorganization of maps is taking place. Now, this is not just a curiosity. It's telling you something fundamental about the human brain. At that time, it was a new insight. People used to believe that the connections in the brain, when I was a medical student or subsequently studying psychology, one of the things I was told was connections to the brain are laid down in the fetus and in early infancy, and once they're laid down, there's nothing you can do to change these connections, and that's why neurological disturbances are so difficult to treat, because it's largely hardwired and you've broken the connections. Well, I'm saying that's wrong. In fact, there's a tremendous malleability of connections so that the entire map can change over a distance of 3 centimeters, and this can happen astonishingly fast in a matter of less than a week. Okay, now the next thing we were curious about is, can you do anything to help these patients because they have what's called phantom pain? So having a phantom is spooky enough, but they have excruciating pain in the missing hand. They'll say it's fixed in a specific position and it's rock solid, it's frozen in a block of ice, it's in cement, it refuses to budge. I only wish I could move it, doctor, then it'll relieve the pain. And I said, well, try moving it. And I said, no, I can't. It just won't budge. And it's like a Charlie horse. There's a cramp. It's excruciatingly painful. Remember, he's talking about his phantom. There is no arm there. So how do you liberate the phantom, make it move again? I mean, it's a long story, but just to tell you very briefly, and it's mentioned in my book, very briefly, we hit on the technique of simply putting a mirror on the table, as shown here, and the chap puts his phantom hand on the left side of the mirror, puts his real hand on the right side of the mirror, and looks at the reflection of the real right hand in the mirror. What does he see? He sees a resurrection of his phantom. It's been visually resurrected, right? Then I said, just move your normal hand, okay, and move the phantom simultaneously as though you're clapping or conducting an orchestra, something symmetrical. He said, well, I can't do that. I can't move my phantom. You know that. And I said, well, give it a shot anyway. Do it. And he said, okay. And he started moving his real hand, and of course, he's going to see his phantom move, the reflection. Immediately, he started jumping up and down like a kid in a candy store and saying, oh my God, this is the first time in 10 years that this hand has started moving, and it's wonderful because it starts moving and I don't feel any pain. So I sent him home with a mirror box and asked him to play with it and to see if this would relieve his pain. And sure enough, whenever he used the box, he would obtain a relief from the cramping sensation, which he would liberate by moving the normal hand and looking at the reflection. Now, all of this has been on the media quite a bit, so I'm going to skip over and say, most recently we've been studying another strange phenomenon, and that is called synesthesia. And this is a phenomenon described by Francis Galton, cousin of Charles Darwin in the 19th century, and he published a little paper in Nature on this phenomenon, and it refers to the fact that some people who are otherwise completely normal, in the normal population, there's a certain proportion of people who have a following peculiarity, and that is every time they see a particular number, it's tinged a particular color. So 5 is red, 6 is blue, 7 is yellow, 8 is indigo, 9 is chartreuse, okay, and so on and so forth. And sometimes tones, every tone is a specific color. C sharp is red, F sharp is green, so on and so forth. And this muddling up of the senses, or mingling of the senses, is called synesthesia. And Galton reported this. He said it runs in families and may have a genetic basis, and he published this in Nature. And since then, there's not been a single careful, systematic study of this phenomenon in the last 120 or 130 years. Now, there have been some explanations of this, there have actually been 4 or 5 explanations. One explanation is they're just nuts. They're crazy. What do you mean 5 is red, 6 is blue? Now, this is a natural reaction in science, and that is, if something doesn't make any sense, you brush it under the carpet. You engage in a form of denial that many of my colleagues are very prone to. So you just pretend it doesn't exist. Now, one of the things you learn in this business is when patients tell you something and you don't understand it, usually it means you're not smart enough to figure it out. Not that they are crazy. Sometimes they're crazy, but usually it's because you're not smart enough, okay? The second explanation is these people are acid junkies and potheads. They've been on drugs. And sure enough, it's more common in Berkeley, I've noticed. And it turns out that people who use LSD report synesthesia, so it's not an absurd conclusion. But this it makes it more interesting, not less interesting. Why would people using drugs experience synesthesia, right? But it doesn't really explain why it happens. The third explanation is, just childhood memories. They were playing with the refrigerator magnets, and 5 was red, and 6 was blue, and 7 is green, and 8 is, whatever. And I said, this doesn't make any sense, because why does it run in families? Then you have to say pass the same magnets down from generation to generation, which again doesn't make much sense, but it's something to keep in mind. The fourth explanation is more ingenious, And maybe these people are being metaphorical. Okay, when they say five is red, just as we say blues music, or you say my tie is loud, the tie doesn't make any sound, why do you say it's loud? Okay, or cheese is sharp, you know, but rub the cheese on your hand, it's soft, why the hell do you say it's sharp? Then you say, well, it's a metaphor when you say it's sharp. But that's circular. Why do you use a gustatory metaphor to explain a touch sensation? These are fascinating, intriguing questions about the mind. But what I'd like to do is turn this upside down and argue as we go along that synesthesia is a concrete sensory phenomenon. It's a genuine phenomenon. They're not crazy. You can figure out what's going on in the brain. And that in turn will give you an experimental technique, a lever to discover how metaphor and analogy and all of that is represented in the human brain. Okay? So how do you get there, starting with this quirky, strange phenomenon all the way to metaphor in Shakespeare? So that's our quest. So the first thing we had to show was this is a real phenomenon. They're not making it up. So we came up with a clinical test. So here's this guy who's telling me five is red, two is green. How do I know he's not making it up? So we created this display. It's all made of fives, but embedded there is a bunch of twos forming a shape. Most normal people look at it and they take half a minute to a minute to say, oh yeah, I see there's a shape there. It's a triangle, or it's a square, or it's a circle. The synesthete says, oh my God, it's an upside down triangle. They see it immediately because of the color. And they say, I see it, a red triangle in a background of green. Now if they're crazy, how come they're better at it than us? Okay? So this shows it's an authentic phenomenon, a sensory phenomenon, and you can actually discover closet synesthetes by giving them this test. Maybe one or two of you here. One of the things we found is it's much more common than people realized. One in 200 people is a synesthete. Okay, so much more common than we have realized in the past. Is there anybody here who is a synesthete? It's a sign of high intelligence, so you should volunteer to come and participate in our experiments at UCSD. And Lisa will give you my email later. Okay, what's going on in the brain? Well, it turned out, Ed Hubbard, who's a grad student in my lab and I, we were looking at brain maps, and you see that red circle there? That's the number area in the brain where visual number representations are there in the brain. We know this from the work of Tim Rickard at our center, Stanis Dehaene in Paris. And that green patch, on the other hand, is called V4. It's a color area of the fusiform gyrus. Now the color area and number area is right next to each other, almost touching. So Ed and I said, my God, this is too good to be true. How come the most common type of synesthesia is number color, and these two areas are almost touching each other in the fusiform gyrus? Maybe there's some cross-wiring in some people, accidental cross-wiring. As in our phantom limb, face to hand, here it's color to number. So every time the person sees a number, it evokes activity in the color area, and he sees a specific color. So how do we test this? Well, we did brain imaging. That's not a real imaging slide, but we've done brain imaging with Jeff Boynton of the SALT. And sure enough, if you show normal people just numbers, only the number area lights up. If you show a synesthete, a number, the number area and the color area lights up. So this directly supports the idea. Now, so far, so good. Now, if you're curious, you'd want to ask some obvious questions of these people. And funnily enough, 150 years, nobody had done that. Simple question, what if you show them, instead of showing them the number five, which is the sort of the Arabic number five, I mean Indian number five, that's where it came from, okay, five or six, what if you showed them a V, a Roman number? Would it evoke a color? The astonishing thing is absolutely not. They look at it and they say, oh, it's five, obviously, that's a six, but there's no color. Now this is important because what it's telling you is it's not the concept of the number that's evoking the color, but the visual appearance of the five or the six, the Indian Arabic numeral, that's causing the color. And that fits because that area, number area in the brain, represents visual appearance, not higher level concepts. So far, so good. Now, what other evidence do we have for this? I'll tell you one other example, which is astonishing. We had a person with synesthesia. We found a colorblind synesthete. Now you said, my God, that's an oxymoron. How can there be a colorblind synesthete? Well, this chap had never seen the full range of colors in the real world because his receptors in his eye were deficient. He couldn't process the range of colors you and I see. He had a very restricted range. But when he saw numbers, he would say, my God, I see a color here which I can never experience in the real world. Oh, six, my God, that's another. He said, that's a Martian color. Okay? So he's experienced color sensations, color qualia, which he can never experience in the real world. Why does that happen? It's because even though his receptors in the eye are deficient, his color area in the brain is still intact and functioning. So when you show a number, it goes and directly activates, bypasses the retina, goes there and directly activates the color center in the brain, so he sees colors. And there's no way you can explain this in terms of memory or metaphor or any of those other explanations, okay? Lastly, we've seen some of these patients. This is true of the first bunch of patients we studied, and that's lucky. Later, we ran into people who not only saw numbers as colored, but they said, oh my God, days of the week are colored. Monday is blue, Tuesday is red, Wednesday is yellow. And they would say months of the year are colored. December is yellow, February is green. No wonder people thought they were crazy. But remember my rule, if you think they're crazy, usually you're not smart enough to figure it out. What do days of the week, months of the year, and numbers have in common? Numbers, sequence, ordinality, okay? Where is that represented in the brain? It turns out probably in the angular gyrus region of the brain. When that's damaged in the left parietal, you get dyscalculia. People have difficulty in calculation. And it turns out the subsequent color processing is also in that general vicinity. So if the cross-wiring happens in the fusiform, lower down, we call it lower synesthetes. They're driven by the visual appearance. If it happens higher up, we call it higher synesthetes. They're driven by the numerical concept rather than the visual appearance. Okay? Now comes an important observation. It's been known for a long time that synesthesia is 8 times more common among poets, artists, novelists, and creative scientists, important creative scientists, not any old scientists, than in the general population. Why would this be? Well, somebody said it's because they're all crazy, but you know, that's not an explanation. So why is it more common among artists, poets, and novelists? Okay. The clue comes from this, and that is what I think is going on. Remember I said there's cross-wiring in the fusiform, that's lower synesthetes. Cross-wiring higher up is the higher synesthetes. What causes this cross-wiring? If there is a gene mutation, it turns out that the infant brain, the fetus brain, everything is connected to everything. I mean, that's an oversimplification, but it's approximately true. There's a great deal of redundancy of connections. And the way you develop the organization, the modular architecture of the adult brain is pruning all those excess connections away. Okay? Now, if something goes wrong with that pruning gene, then you're going to get cross-wiring between adjacent brain areas. You're going to get synesthesia. If that gene is selectively expressed because of transcription factors in the fusiform, you're going to get a lower synesthete. If it's expressed in the angular gyrus region, you're going to get a higher synesthete. And we're now doing the imaging experiments to test that. What if it's expressed everywhere in the brain? Then you're going to get cross-activation throughout the brain, right? And if complex ideas, concepts are represented in brain maps, and there's a lot of clinical evidence to support that, then this cross-wiring throughout the brain is going to make people produce unexpected links between different conceptual regions of the brain, and that's the basis of metaphor and creativity. As when Shakespeare says, it is the East and Juliet is the Sun. You don't say Juliet is the sun, does that mean she's a glowing ball of fire? Now, schizophrenics do that. They take metaphors literally. And that's a whole another talk, but we don't do that. Okay? You know immediately, no, she's radiant like the sun. She's warm like the sun. She's nurturing like the sun. You know, your brain makes all the appropriate links, and Shakespeare was a master at doing this. Or when Tagore, the Indian poet, referred to the Taj Mahal, and he said the Taj Mahal is a teardrop on the cheek of time. I mean, I can't think of a better way of conveying what the Taj is other than the manner in which Tagore conveyed it, okay? Using a very elegant metaphor. So, in short, this synesthesia gene, if it's expressed everywhere, you get somebody who's more creative, more prone to metaphor, ability to link seemingly unrelated ideas. Now, you could say that, people often ask me, if it's that good, why don't we all have it? Well, there's two answers. One answer is evolution takes time. Maybe a time will come and we all have it, okay? The second answer is maybe it's not good for everybody to have it, okay? You need some heterogeneity in the gene pool. You don't want some neurosurgeon to be very creative when he's doing neurosurgery. You know, you just want him to, you know, just stay there, right? Not think outside the box too much. So this type of heterogeneity, thank God, is what we celebrate, is what's called diversity. I don't mean diversity in the political sense, but simply in the human sense of having diverse abilities and skills. Okay, so we've gone all the way from the gene to things like metaphor. And that's the power of this approach, cognitive neuroscience, how you can take some arcane, seemingly bizarre syndrome and find out what's going on in the brain, and that in turn has vast implications for understanding other aspects of human nature that are interesting to everybody, not just to specialists. In this case, representation of metaphors and creativity in the human brain. The last thing I'd like to talk about very briefly, how are we doing for time, Lisa?
We're okay.
I want to say a little bit about the emergence of language. I'm not going to talk about it at length because that'll take another whole hour. But the question is, how did something as complex as language, human language, with its infinite possibilities, combinatorial possibilities, the hierarchic nesting of clause within clause, and what we linguists call recursive embedding, all of this evolve? How do you begin from the grunts and groans and howls of our ape-like ancestors and get to all the sophistication of a Shakespeare or a George Bush? Okay? So this is an astonishing mystery how it all came about. And one question which I will answer is, how did words emerge, the early vocabulary? Okay, we have an astonishingly wide range of words, human beings. So did our ancestors, ape-like ancestors, hominids, sit around the fireplace and say, this is an axe, everybody say axe? Of course not, right? So if it didn't happen, how did it happen? Well, the answer comes from, oddly enough, I want to tell you something interesting here. You may all think synesthesia is a little quirky phenomenon in the brain. I already told you it's relevant to metaphor, but let me also point out, you're all synesthetes to some extent. And how do I show that? Okay, here I've got a couple of Martian alphabets, right? Just like E, the letter E is A is A, B is B, C is C, different shapes are different sounds. This is Martian alphabet. One is Kiki, the other is Booba. How many of you see the left one as Kiki and the right one as Booba? Raise your hands. Okay, there's 1, 2, 3 mutants in the audience. How many of you see the right one as Kiki, left one as Booba? Okay, nearly all of you. Okay. Now, if you've done this on hundreds of people, about 90 to 95% pick the right one as Kiki, left one as Booba. Why is that? Well, it's because you're all synesthetes, because that sound, key, that shape, the visual inflection of that contour, the visual contour, the inflection, the sudden inflection mimics the sound inflection in your auditory cortex, key, key, not to mention your tongue going to your palate and coming back, key, key, okay? So there is this cross-modal synesthesia going on even in you versus booba, the undulation of the tongue on your palate, booba, okay? That undulation is being captured by that undulating amoeboid shape, right? Now, question is, how is this relevant to the evolution of language? But let's take words. The question is, how can you create arbitrary sounds and match them to arbitrary visual shapes? This is the question raised by Sejour, okay? My answer is, it wasn't arbitrary when you started. There's already a pre-existing bias to link certain shapes with certain sounds. And once you get the bias in place, that's all you need in evolution, then it cascades into a sequence of events that leads to the final emergence of proto-language. Now, things like embedding, recursive embedding, all of that I won't go into because we don't have time. Also, very important, you may think this is a little quirk in the brain, I'm using demonstration booba kiki. Okay, so what? Well, it's very important, I'll tell you why. What you're seeing here is the emergence of that unique ability, uniquely human ability, which is quintessentially human, called abstraction. Now, why do I mean that? This is just a bunch of photons in the slide, from the slide projector. What's hitting your eye is a bunch of photons. The sound kiki is a bunch of hair cells in your ear. These two things have absolutely nothing in common. The only thing they have in common is the abstract property of kikiness in some mathematical Fourier space, and the brain is extracting or abstracting this property of kikiness. So you're seeing the beginnings of the process called abstraction that we humans excel at. When and how did that happen? So first of all, where does it happen in the brain? So I think it happened in a particular region of the brain called the inferior parietal lobule, especially part of it called the angular gyrus. It turns out that the inferior parietal lobule, when it's damaged in humans, especially when the angular gyrus is damaged, you get some characteristic symptoms, like the patient can no longer do arithmetic and has problems left-right. But other than that, he's quite conversationally, he's fine, his intellect is fine, all of that is fine. If you talk to him for 10 minutes, you may not notice anything wrong. But guess what we found? When we gave him the Buba-Kiki test, and a number of other pairs like that, not just Buba-Kiki, he was at chance level. So clearly you need the inferior parietal lobule to perform this task of cross-modal abstraction. The vision coming from the visual cortex, which is at the back, the hearing coming from the temporal lobe, and the touch coming from the parietal lobe, all converging onto the angular gyrus, which is strategically located in between the parietal touch region, the occipital vision region, and the auditory, temporal auditory region. So it's located right there at the crossroads, ideally situated to combine information from different senses and abstract this property of kikiness. Sure enough, when that's damaged, you lose this ability. The other amazing thing we found is these patients also lose the ability to interpret metaphor and proverb. Okay? How do I know that? Well, you had a couple of patients not long ago talking to me, and I said, look, I want you to interpret this. All that glitters is not gold. What does that mean? He said, well, you know, if something is bright and shiny and yellow, it doesn't mean it's gold. It could be copper. And I said, I know, but is there any deeper meaning, you know, beyond what the actual meaning? Is there any deeper meaning? He said, yeah, the deeper meaning is you have to be very careful when you go to a jewelry shop, because those guys are out to rip you off. You have to take the specific gravity of the metal. So he's smart. He's telling you to take the specific gravity to find out if it's really gold or not. He's not stupid. But he cannot go beyond the literal interpretation. Now, I know he's perfectly intelligent. He's not dumb, because he often gives you, even though he can't interpret the proverb, he'll give you elaborate, convoluted, even ingenious interpretations of the proverb, but completely missing the mark, like the people who review my grant proposals. Yeah. Okay. Now, why did this structure emerge in the human brain, the angular gyrus? To simply combine information from the different senses, or for metaphor, or for Buba-Kiki. It couldn't have evolved for Buba-Kiki. Why did it evolve? By the way, I'm going to pause here and I say, I believe only in evolution. Evolution through Darwinian natural selection. I don't believe in intelligent design. It is ironic that our president is championing the cause of intelligent design when his own existence is a living negation of any such principle. Okay, let's go back to the angular gyrus. Why did it evolve such this amazing ability to abstract information from different sensory systems? The answer, believe it or not, is if you go back in early primates, Tom can correct me, this isn't right, but if you go back to the lower primates, and then you follow the development of the angular gyrus, it became bigger in primates than in other mammals, became even bigger in the great apes, and became positively enormous in human beings. So something was selecting for the explosive enlargement of the angular gyrus, and indeed the inferior parietal lobule in humans. And what was that? The answer is we used to climb on trees. And when you're climbing on trees, you need to match the visual vertical or visual horizontal to the proprioceptive muscle and joints informing the brain in a completely different area, the somatosensory area, that your arm is poised correctly to make a vertical grasp or a horizontal grasp. So this need, and again, these signals are utterly different from visual signals, visual vertical or visual horizontal. These are just photons. This is muscle spindles and joints telling you what's vertical, what's horizontal. The brain has to combine these two maps and establish a congruence. And once that ability was required, the angular gyrus got going, and then you develop the ability to do all kinds of cross-modal abstraction, eventually even culminating in the ability to engage in metaphor and other types of abstraction. Okay? So I think I'll conclude with that by simply saying that in the old days, when we were students, we were told there are certain questions about the brain you should stay away from, otherwise you won't get tenure. Like, what is metaphor? What is poetry? How do you construct a body image? What is art? And what I'm arguing now is, all of these years this has remained the province of philosophy. But what I'm arguing now is you can bring this from the philosophers, we scientists can begin to explore this by doing the right kinds of experiments on the right patient populations and combining it with brain imaging. We can begin to address many of these lofty questions. Thank you.
Take a couple of minutes of questions for Rama, and then we'll move into the bookworks for Rama will be happy to sign his books, and we'll have a wine and cheese reception. So a few questions, please.
One here, one in the back.
You mentioned that science now has the opportunity to look at questions which are formally philosophical. Given that, here's the context. Right now, in physics, as I understand it, there are deterministic phenomena and there's random phenomena. But we all seem to believe that we have the capacity to make choices. Do you see any possibility of pursuing the notion of volition, free will?
Well, you should ask my colleague Patricia Churchland, who has written extensively about free will. The answer is the old billiard ball deterministic view of the universe we know is incorrect. Quantum mechanical effects, which are essentially random, although Einstein never believed it. Given that uncertainty and randomness, there is scope for something like free will. But what many people have argued, including Pat Churchland, that only gives scope for erratic behavior, not for the intervention of something, or for capricious behavior, not for what you normally subjectively experience as the will. What I would suggest is this sort of gets into metaphysical issues, and what I would strongly recommend is a book by Erwin Schrödinger, the great physicist, and he has thought very deeply about this very question. And I think I've learned more from that physicist about free will and about consciousness than any of the other material that's currently available. It's called Mind and Matter. It's available as a paperback. I shouldn't be pushing somebody else's book, but
that's okay. Maybe you can come.
Oh, sorry. There's one way at the back, and we'll, can I take that, and then I'll come to you? Yeah.
In the last chapter, you talked about consciousness form, meta representation.
Yes.
Could you just discuss that elaborately?
I can do that, except it requires a lot of time. So I mentioned very briefly. What is consciousness? What is qualia? If I look at a red object, there's just little jelly, wisps of jelly firing away, ionic fluxes. They look nothing like this red thing I'm looking at. Where does the redness come from? Or the flavor of paneer tikka masala, or if you're English, marmite, or fish and chips. Where does that come from, that exquisite flavor, right? They're just neurons in your brain, so where does that come from? Francis Crick was responsible largely for reviving an interest in what used to be a philosophical question, claiming that just like life, what is life used to be a philosophical question, but now we know it's a molecule, right? And maybe something like that will happen for consciousness, and maybe figure out what the neural cellular basis is. So that's the overarching theme. My way of tackling this is to argue that there's an early sensory representation of red or green or whatever, which we share with all animals. All mammals, all even amphibians, birds, or whatever. But in humans, we evolved another system. I like to call it a parasitic brain, which takes as its input the output of these early sensory representations. Just as the early sensory representation take the optics, physical input, and transform it into representations for action, we developed another mechanism for creating what I call a meta representation, which in turn is linked to our language abilities in the Wernicke's area, and linked to your ability to juggle tokens which are created entirely in your mind, like redness or greenness and blueness, and you can juggle these tokens in your mind offline. And this type of offline symbol manipulation, which is parasitic partly on language centers, is what gives genuine qualia to otherwise sensory impressions which otherwise lack qualia. So I'd argue that there's no such thing as an earlier stage of awareness and a later stage of awareness. There is only a later stage. At earlier stage, you're not aware, period. It only comes into play when there is a sense of agency and self, which is linked to those sensory inputs. But I know it requires an hour, sorry. Two more, please.
When you talked about the cross-wiring, is that related to dyslexia?
To what?
Dyslexia.
Yes.
And
yes.
Also, if you could stimulate that part of the brain for colorblind people, maybe you could overcome the colorblindness.
Yeah. Dyslexia is not something we have studied in any detail. We have studied autism, by the way, in some detail, and we have a theory about what's causing autism. But dyslexia is another developmental disorder. It encompasses a wide range of related and unrelated disturbances in your ability to read. People have suggested that it involves partial deficits in the angular gyrus, which we know is required for putting information from vision and hearing, saying the name of a letter or the name of a word. So naturally there would be confusion in appreciating or reading words and letters of the alphabet, which is the characteristic of dyslexia. So some such deficit undoubtedly underlies dyslexia. Your second question was?
If you could stimulate that part of the brain to enable people who are colorblind to see everything.
Yeah, our techniques are not, in principle, yes. But in practice, our techniques are not refined enough. The first step is to take people who are simply lack visual input because of congenital cataract or retinoblastoma, retinitis pigmentosa, the eyes are completely gone. Can you artificially stimulate the visual cortex to help them restore some semblance of vision? People like Baki Rita, who pioneered this technology, and Giles Brindley, in the early days, suggested it was possible. It was thrown aside. And now people are starting to realize that may indeed be possible. Yes? How can you become one? Take LSD. You didn't hear that from me, but
the first part of the talk was how the stimulus can actually change rewiring. The second part was about the genetic basis of polymorphism.
Well, I alluded to polymorphism in the sense I was talking about the heterogeneity causing some synesthetes to be artists and metaphorical and all of that. Can you learn to be a synesthete? We have tried, others have tried, giving people repeatedly five red for hours on an end. You have to really pay them well because it's very boring. You know. And the answer, the short answer is no. You can't create a synesthete. And all of the synesthetes we have studied, they have been synesthetes. If you ask them how long, they'll say, as far back into childhood as I can remember, I have been a synesthete. I didn't tell people about it because they would think I was crazy. Or they'll say, what's the big deal? I thought everybody saw this. So you get two reactions.
So reading Tagore in childhood doesn't make me
think more. No, that's different. You can't become these number color synesthetes. But I do believe, but can you become more metaphorical? I think very much so. I think that I'm emphasizing angular gyrus, evolution, genetics, but I think it's entirely possible that some of these connections, my earlier work on phantom limb showed how malleable these connections are. Reading, I think in our school curriculum, instead of wasting time on grammar and spelling and all of that, grammar is already wired into your brain. I mean, this is shown by Chomsky. You should make people more, expose them to poetry, to metaphor, even jokes. Have classes on humor and jokes, because jokes involve an unusual juxtaposition of ideas, which is the basis of creativity. Now, they may end up just becoming comedians, so you have to watch out. But hopefully the same skills of linking seemingly unrelated things will spill over into other domains, so you train them with poetry and metaphor and jokes and humor. They may become creative, period, in all dimensions, and that would be worth doing. Unless you're planning to, he's planning to become an engineer or a surgeon, then you don't want to go there. Sorry. Yes. Oh, sorry. Can we? One more. Okay.
Just my question is about LSD. Do you consider a way of studying human consciousness, maybe not a scientific level, but more a spiritual level? Is there any better to envision using drugs of any kind to better understand their own?
Yeah. I would think so. And I think that what's happening is the LSD may be causing some disinhibition between regions that are inhibiting each other, and therefore there is some level of autonomy in the normal brain, suddenly start activating each other. But this cannot be studied systematically. If there's anybody here who wants to volunteer, it'll be completely anonymous, but I'm not supposed to even announce that, because it's illegal to test this sort of thing. Yeah.
I think that we've taken enough of Rama's time. Rama, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Also, I would like us to also please thank Rose on a personal note for allowing us to be here and to do this. Thank you, Rose.
Okay, thank you. All this program scripts for all the employees.
Because you can't find them.